Yeah, we're live.
Uh-huh.
I can feel it. Jeremy's shutting windows. This is the Freedom Fiends, unwinding your mind and sacroiliacing your synapses through Juden radio waves. We bring you the solution to all your problems that you didn't know till you turned on the radio. And we told you. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with 3D glasses, which you should put on now, to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it, Jeremy and Angela? Is it working? Can you feel it?
I feel something, but that may be the heat rushing to my head. It's hot, yeah. Man.
Angela?
I feel moved.
Yeah. Okay. Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOD no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOD.org. And Angela's doing a makeup test show. She was supposed to be on last night. And Bill Gates, show me on the doll where Bill Gates touched you, Angela, rendered you unable to do the show.
It's the lies. And, you know, people always ask, what about Windows 7? What about Windows 10 is my question.
What about it?
I hate Windows 10.
I know.
I think it's affected the way my computer's operated since the upgrade.
Well, that would make sense. Is it better?
Not in a good way. It's good and bad. Every day I find new quirks.
Well, fortunately for you then, and unfortunately for Jeremy, I don't know if Jeremy knows this. I told Angela this today. I broke the news to her this afternoon in our pregame chat. Jeremy, did you know that Windows 10 is the final version of Windows? It's never going to be higher than that.
I did not know that, but that doesn't surprise me. Why not leave off with the biggest pile of crap ever?
Little updates here and there. I actually like it better than 7, but I know what I'm doing. I mean, I have a newer computer. No. Jeremy.
Okay, you're both on right accounts, but that's not the point here.
I like that I can't hear your crickets as much and you're suffering for your art. Tell us about that.
Well, I shut all the windows to keep my cheering section at bay because I know they disturb you. So yes, the crickets.
They don't just disturb me. They make the show bad. You make it sound like I'm, you know, I know I have this joke nickname as the audio Nazi, and you even call yourself audio Nazi in training, but there really aren't Fiends episodes that are unlistenable, and there are a lot of libertarian stuff out there where they'd be like, huh, I don't mind the crickets, man. It's cool. Besides, I want to be comfortable. And then they make unlistenable shows. Do you know how many of those there are? You don't care, do you?
That's not true at all. I have no idea how many there are, and of course I care.
Okay.
Well, listen, the first couple of times we had this issue, you appreciated the crickets. I can't control them outside.
There's a difference.
Because the cicadas decided to join in. What am I supposed to do? Yeah. Kill them all? Believe me, I wish I could.
Earlier in the summer, when it was just crickets, and it wasn't as many even of them, it sounded good. It was kind of a pleasant backwoodsy prairie home companion kind of feel, or, you know, Michigan or upstate New York woods feel. But when the cicadas joined in, it just became white noise. It kind of sounds like when your windows are open, it kind of sounds like you have the water faucet running next to you during the show.
Wow.
So we got rid of it. So speaking of being out in the woods and complaining about my striving for, I'm not even striving for perfection. I'm striving for passability. And when we've got 15 different hosts on $50 microphones in different cities, passability is all I'm really looking for. And we achieve that nightly, unlike Tom Woods, for instance. What do you think? Oh, he sounds good. He sounds good now. He used to sound horrible, but he sounds good now. But his guests often sound horrible, and he lets them sound horrible. Like Tom Woods, and he blames he's the poor workman blaming his tools. He says, oh, well, you know, I have no control over them. You do have control over them. You know, like, for instance, if they have a heater or a fan on the background, you could have them turn it off. And you could say, oh, but I wanted to be comfortable. No, man, you're making art for the ages, or you should be. You know, I mean, Tom Woods interviews people who... It should be the best interview they do. It should be the thing that pops up at the top of Google. It should be the canonical, the canon of that person. But no, he doesn't care about audio. So, you know, it sounds like crap. So you've been out in the woods, Jeremy. Tell us about it. Where were you and what happened?
Well, I just got back last night from the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest out in Michigan. It was a heck of a lot of fun. Three, four nights camping, whatever it was. I don't even remember. It was a long drive both ways for me. It's actually the furthest. Drive time was a little over 11 hours, which wow. I've been to the West Coast once in my life on a plane, and that was for like 30 hours, but I've never driven this far west. So this was an experience for me and my dog.
Michigan is that far west? Wow.
It's for me, yeah. I mean, I'm out on Long Island, which is one of the furthest east points of the entire country outside of like Maine.
Yeah.
You know. So, but it was a lot of fun. I got to a couple of the other fiends were there, Diana, Lou, and I finally got to meet Randy, which was exciting.
Randy England, he'll be on tomorrow night with Lou and Diana, and tomorrow night is Diana's birthday. Who else did you meet that you hadn't met before that you'd talked to on the internet?
Oh, well, I met James Weeks, who we interviewed here, and I also interviewed on Seeds of Liberty. I got to meet the guys from the Anarchy Roundtable, who I've talked to for a while, and actually had one of them, Joe Allen, on my show a couple weeks ago. I'm trying to think. I know I met a bunch of people. I'm going to forget names and stuff, but I had numerous people come up to me and hear me from across this campsite and go, hey, wait a minute, you're Jeremy, aren't you? just from recognizing my voice. I actually got one cool story. One guy named Peter, I believe his name was, came up to talk to me, and he said to me, he told me this, you know, he gave me the standard, hey, I know you. I know your voice. I hear you all the time. And my instinctive reaction now is to say, oh, I get that all the time, but I don't mean it to be rude like that, but I guess it must have came off like that because he apologized right away and I felt bad. But then he came back to me the next day and he said, listen, I feel really bad about, you know, just telling you the same thing you always hear from everybody. And I tried to explain to him that's not what I meant. But then he told me that his girlfriend actually was deaf and just had the cochlear implants.
Yeah.
Put in, and she's still getting adjusted to listening. She's still not really hearing things yet, but he was listening to an episode of The Fiends, and she was able to pick out and recite an exact quote of mine because my voice was the one she was able to hear. I guess because of the decibel level, you know, the
well, it's also voice. It's also because we strive for good audio.
Well, yes, of course. She wouldn't be able to hear anything.
And I'm not saying, oh, pat me on the back. I'm like, I'm trying to get everyone to do this. I don't want to be the owner of bad audio. I mean, of good audio. That's not my goal, of bad audio. My goal is to get everyone in Liberty to have good audio because we have to have good audio. We have to have audio that's as good as mainstream media audio before anyone will even consider taking us seriously. That's my theory. So if you know, I'm kind of touched that somebody heard you on The Fiends and on your show, which I've tried to help get the audio better on, and could recognize you, and they're basically a deaf person. That means what we're doing is working, you know, and you have a good voice. But, you know, if you were on the Tom Woods show with the audio he usually has of his co-host on there and you were a guest on there and she heard it, she wouldn't recognize you.
This is probably true. I feel so bad. I feel so bad torturing the man who I consider my red pill. But you're right. I can't ignore that anymore. I listen to every one of his episodes, and some of those really are painful to listen to.
Yeah. Who's good? Who does he have on that cares enough to be good?
I will tell you who has really, really good audio because I reposted this show tonight on antiwar.com's Twitter. But Tom Woods' interview with Larissa Alexandrovna about the 28 pages.
Yes.
Sounds beautiful.
That was a good one. Wait a minute, isn't that Scott's wife? I'm so confused. Which was the one with the Edward? Didn't he have Scott Horton's wife on there one time talking about something?
That's Larissa Alexandrovna. Right. Yes. When yes. the when the Raw story was good, that was her.
Mm.
Now the Raw story is not good. It's almost unrecognizable.
What do you mean by that?
The Raw story has become a mildly progressive version of InfoWars in terms of the sensational.
I don't know what the Raw story is.
I thought you were using the phrase. Site.
Oh, okay. It's a site. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, it used to be a very good progressive to left-leaning site, and now it's just a catastrophe.
What makes a good left-leaning site? That sounds horrible to me, but I guess, I mean, in a way, some people would consider Anti-War Radio or Scott Horton's show left-leaning because it's anti-war, but I don't really consider that a bastion of the left anymore. It's not even a bastion of either side because, you know, I mean, what did Obama do? Continue Bush's war of, you know, murdering innocent people 50 at a time to try to get one bad guy at a wedding party. So I don't think that's very progressive. I guess he's progressing. He's becoming more of a warmonger, you know.
Yeah.
I'm asking a question. That's not rhetorical. I'm asking Angela, what is a good left side? That sounds horrifying. Why shouldn't it be?
Well, there's several things to look at. I mean, the quality of journalism, how much they critique those in power, how much are they beholden to Democratic Party interests. For example, I mean, I'll give you two sites that are to the left. One's somewhat to the left, one's very to the left. One site would be Alternet. Does a lot of reprints, but
that's an old school one, man. That was like when the web started, Alternet was one of the sites I used to look at. I remember that.
Still runs some very, very good media criticism. They have a really good guy now. I think his name's Adam Johnson, who writes a lot of good anti-empire material. But Alternet's still a progressive site. It's kind of weak. It doesn't probably question those in let's say the Clinton regime. Let me as harshcounterpunch.org. They are constantly critiquing those in power, and they're very, very hard on the Democratic Party establishment and on the whole Hillary Clinton machine.
I kind of like Code Pink because while what's her name's really screechy, they're still like some of the only left out there that's didn't suddenly praise the war when Obama took over, you know.
No, and Mdia Benjamin doesn't get enough credit for bringing that kind of protest back. I realize there's people who find that unseemly and ineffective, but it takes a pair.
We're going to the break. We'll be back after this trip to the free market.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's Antiwar.com.
So Jeremy was talking about, we took a little fork in the road there that we'll come back to you later about what's wrong with the world. But I want to talk about what's right with the world. So Jeremy, tell me more about the Michigan Peace and Liberty Fest. You brought your murder dog, right? Your pit bull?
Yes, I did. And I have to correct you only because I was corrected numerous times because I kept getting wrong. It's the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, which is put on by the Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition. I think that's how it works.
Like that,
yes, they like to confuse people.
Is your murder dog a hit?
Yeah, everybody loved Cammy. I mean, Roxy, Diana's dog, was still, of course, the star of the show because she's been around a bunch of times before. But Cameron was actually the only quote unquote unleashed dog there most of the time because part of the rules of the place, which is it's a private establishment, so I can respect this, is that, you know, your dogs have to be on leash and the owner has to be paying attention to them. Well, I took that to mean that the dog had to have a leash on and then I had to watch her. So that's what I did. I put the leash around her neck and tucked it up underneath like the rest of the leash so it wasn't dragging on the ground, and just let her wander around most of the time. Nobody else seemed to be doing that, but she was great. And nobody said anything to me, so I think it was okay.
Nice.
So she basically, I basically let her carry her own leash for most of the weekend.
There was sometimes constitutionalist.
Yeah, kind of. But, you know, it made her happy. She was, I mean, she was ecstatic. She's been stuck inside most of the summer because it's been too hot for me to take her to work with me. So she doesn't get her normal exercise. So she got to run around in the woods.
Isn't your work walking dogs?
Yeah, but if it's too hot and there's stops that I have cats as well where I would have to leave her in the car for half an hour, I'm not going to do that on ridiculously hot days. So for the past month or so, she's been stuck at home. She hasn't been coming with me. So, you know, getting out and to run in the woods, because I used to take her camping when she was a puppy. We did it at least once a year. And it's been so long since we've got out to do it. So she was great. Everybody there was great. And, you know, There was lots of dogs there. There was lots of little anarchists running around. I was kind of bummed. One of my daughters was supposed to come with us, but she had to bail at the last second because she came down with a fever that morning, and which actually was probably better than it coming down later in the day, because if we had been in the middle of a car ride somewhere in Ohio or Pennsylvania and she started complaining to a fever about to me, it would have been a lot more difficult. So she couldn't go, which kind of stunk, but the murder dog and I made do. And, you know, we all made some friends, and I got to, you know, as well as Randy and some of the other people that I've been talking to, there is a small group of individuals that I have become friends with over the past year or so through the Telegram app that, you know, we set up a chat for Seeds of Liberty and just said, hey, people, come on in. And a bunch of people did. And a smaller group of us kind of became really good friends and talked pretty much every day. And I finally got a chance to meet, I think, three or four of them at least. So that's really cool. So to me, that's what's right with the world. See, now we talk about me with bad audio. Who's typing in the background? I hear typing. Why do I hear typing?
But you're hearing good audio of it.
always a justification for you. But anyway, so
always a dicky comment from you, but go on.
Well, that's true. I am an a-hole. but that's the, but yeah, but we talk, you know, you're talking about what's right with the world. I love these. I, you know, this is my second festival this year. I love these experiences because there's so many people that I've come in contact with that when they first hear me or somebody else, or I get in contact with them and they say, I feel all alone. There's nobody like me around me, and they have to rely on talking to people on the interwebs or on the phone or something. And to finally get a, you know, I'm one of those people. I felt all alone here for years. And now that I get to get out and meet these people and actually see them face to face and talk to them and, you know, drink a beer with them, eat some of loose food with them, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Nice.
And we're going to try to, now we're trying to start our own festival next year. The original intent was to kind of rival Porkfest. Not that we thought we would get anywhere near the numbers to start off, but, you know, we're shooting for that too.
Wait, who's we and what are you starting? Why aren't you just going to continue to support this one? It sounds like it's the new Pork Fest already anyway.
Oh no, I'm still gonna go to this one too, but the idea of having multiple festivals all over the place so they can kind of run all year round, and you could some people there's because there
like
are
the
people
Grateful
that
Dead tours, you could be a fest head.
Exactly. That's kind of, there's already people that do that, and we just, you know, a couple of my friends and I, we want to continue that and make another one.
Isn't
so
Dobby kind of doing that right now?
I think so, actually. No, I did not see Dobby.
Yeah.
But.
Well, cool.
So, lots of fun.
Nice, man. You got any closing comments on it?
Everybody go to the Midwest Peace Celebrity Fest next year. Don't miss it this time.
Cool. Take the ad out of rotation, too, please.
Yeah, that's already out.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. I've run websites since 1996 and have used over a dozen web hosts in that time. AgoristHosting.com is the only one that hasn't broken my heart. Agorist Hosting's uptime and service is stellar, and their DDoS mitigation is the best I've seen. That's important because if you tell the truth in this world, you'll ruffle feathers. No matter what the haters hit us with, Agorist Hosting keeps our websites online. If you have a mission-critical commercial presence or a world-changing activism site, Go with agoristhosting.com.
Talk about a little movie called Elvis and Nixon, which I mistakenly called a documentary before I saw it on the show a couple nights ago. It's not a documentary. It's a biopic, I guess, about, I don't know, it's a drama. It's a scripted drama and a pretty historically accurate one, by all accounts, about a meeting between Elvis Presley and Richard Nixon that took place in the early 70s. And Elvis was a weird cat, Elvis Presley. If you don't know who that is, look him up. Ask your parents. Ask your grandparents. He was a singer who kind of reached godlike proportions in people's hearts. And it's actually a Dead Kennedys line. Will Elvis take the place of Jesus in 1,000 years? Maybe. It's possible.
That's such a line.
Yeah, it is. And that's from the Frankenchrist album, which is a beautiful album. It's my second favorite Dead Kennedys album. It's a very psychedelic sounding album. They actually had an ad for it that said that. It said, Frankenchrist bringing the pain back to psychedelic music. And I liked it. So this movie, which stars,
Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Spacey as Nixon. And he does a really surprisingly good job. I mean, a lot of Nixon is the mannerisms, but they also kind of made him look like him, kind of shaved his head a little bit, you know, for his weird, that weird, like kind of bald spot he had on both sides of his head. It's widow's peak. But the funny thing about it too is that Spacey is second billed to the guy who plays Elvis in this, who's Michael Shannon, who's, you know, Kevin Spacey's a huge, huge movie star, and Michael Shannon's kind of one of those, oh yeah, that guy, you know, that guy that was in that thing, kind of actors.
Yeah, and I couldn't place him when I saw him in the credits.
I could place him once I read it. I saw it. The thing I remember him from is, he plays Eminem's mother's abusive boyfriend in 8 Mile.
Oh, there you go.
You know, the one that, like, at some point Eminem's yelling at him and says, like, my God, we went to high school together. What are you doing dating my mother? But, but yeah. Yeah. And he's really, really good in it. And so, Elvis Presley, I want to nominate. People call him the king of rock and roll. I want to nominate him and crown him tonight as what he really is, which is the king of the squarest rocker ever. How square is this? Like you know, I always thought it's pretty square when, like, we had an episode of The Fiends about 4 years ago, Nima Vidati and I, called The Squarest Thing Any Musician Can Do Is Back Any Politician. You know, when, like, people like Bono from U2 get huge, and then, like, their next step is kind of getting involved in politics and telling people who to vote for and things like that. I think that's pretty square, but Elvis was far squarer than that, because the reason he met Nixon, and this is true, he went out of his way to get a meeting with Nixon, was Elvis Presley wanted a federal narcotics agent badge. This is before the DEA, but he wanted the position that he made up in his head, he thought was real. He said he wanted a federal agent at large badge so he could go undercover and bust the Beatles and the Beach Boys. Like that is
the dirty commies
ever, man. I know, you thought they were commies, which they probably were, but still no reason to.
Well, he singled out
for drugs.
He singled out John. He may not have been too far off on that, but you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it but was.
And the irony, of course, is that Elvis was out of his mind on prescription drugs, you know, probably while he was meeting with Nixon. He got it from a doctor, one of those Dr. Feelgood guys, Dr. Nicolopoulos, who was actually who Dr. Nick Riviera on The Simpsons is based on. You know, the hi.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dr. Nick. I love Dr. Nick.
Yep. Yeah. Hitler had a Dr. Feelgood too. You know, I guess that's what happens when you get that rich and powerful. You just own a private physician who travels with you and you're his only patient. And he just gives you whatever you want. Hitler was shooting speed and coke and heroin and Dilaudid all the time from his personal Dr. Feelgood. So I guess having a Dr. Feelgood makes you into a tyrant. So what'd you think, Jeremy?
I thought it was an interesting movie. I recall hearing about that photograph, which was the kind of the basis of this whole thing.
That photograph is the most requested picture from the National Archives.
Yeah.
That picture of Elvis and Nixon shaking hands, and Elvis is wearing this giant belt buckle that looks like a pro wrestling prize, and he's wearing a purple cape. Well, it's black and white, but he's wearing a cape. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had heard, you know, I've obviously seen the picture before, but I didn't really know any of the story. And it's funny, I could see how you could mistake it as a documentary. The tagline on Amazon Prime says this is the untold true story. So, yeah. But I kind of figured, you know, you said that Spacey did a surprisingly good job. I expect him to do great work no matter what he does. I've always been a huge fan of Kevin Spacey's. I think he's a fantastic actor. So I kind of figured if anybody could nail it, he would. But it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't just the mannerisms. He actually, not only did they kind of get him to look like him a little bit, but he had the voice down pretty well too.
Yeah. Yep.
And I think, but the big part of the story, aside from Elvis being a huge, huge square, which really was disappointing. I mean, I was never a huge Elvis fan, but that's still kind of disappointing to hear that he was that. I mean, what did they say that he went? They, you know, he had all these badges from all these sheriff's departments all over the country, and then he just wanted this badge, and he made it his goal. And like the speech he gave to Nixon about the drugs and the commies taking the country down, and we need to do something. It was so disheartening, but the real story seemed to really be about Elvis and his buddy from back home, the one guy who knew how did he refer to him? He knew Elvis as, not as the thing, but as the actual person, which nobody else seemed to do.
Well, that's, you know, there's a kind of unwritten rule of screenwriting, is that every story needs to be a romance. And I think in this case, they kind of played up the bromance. You know, it was not a sexual or romantic love, but there was a brotherly love between those two. And, you know, without that, this is just kind of a docudrama. But they had to put that in, I think, to kind of make the story real. And I generally, unless the story is really about a romance, I don't generally like the romance that's kind of forced into every screenplay, and I didn't really like that much. It was okay, but I think they spent too much time on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're probably right about that. There probably was a reason it was in there, but I don't know. I kind of like that part of the story. I also really like the character that Colin Hanks played. What is it? Croft, or the aide to the president? Oh, yeah.
That guy ended up going to prison.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, that was great at the end, where they get right before the credits started, when they do the black screen, and then they just flash up what happened to a couple of the people. You know, they describe how Elvis's friend went on to be pretty successful, and how Elvis died, and then the Nixon guy, both of Nixon's aides ended up in prison.
and if you want to, you know, I think you could really conjecture about how much of this dialogue in this is probably made up, because you know, for some of it, nobody was in the room except Nixon and Elvis, and neither of them really talked about it very much. Nixon talked about it a tiny bit, I think, in his autobiography later. But you know, Elvis didn't want to talk about it at all, because he wanted to be undercover. He didn't want the public to know that meeting ever took place. And some of what was said in that room is known by what those two aides said, and then some of it is conjecture, because some of it, the only people in the room were Nixon and Elvis, and they never really told what was said. But keep in mind that, you know, the part that came through those two aides were arrested for lying to Congress. So, you know, maybe they're not the most reliable narrators.
take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, although, you know, is lying to Congress really a lie? I don't think so. But
it's a noble lie, in my opinion. But
what do you think, Angela?
I love drug lies.
What do you mean by that?
Stories about drugs. Elvis, the square guy, didn't he die on the toilet?
Yeah.
Yes, from pretty much a narc overdose, one would assume, or pill. Too many relaxers.
Yeah, but yeah, those were legal drugs. Those don't count, Angela.
Dr. Dope. It was Dr. Dope. You know, that guy, Little Mike, that I talk about sometimes on here, that people see me talking with still on Twitter. We're still friends. The guy that I told the story about, his dad. My girlfriend and I took acid, and she painted a picture of his dad with a bunch of balls, and we delivered it to his dad and made his dad think it came from Little Mike. Little Mike, when I first met him, had a band. I can't remember the name of it, but they had one song that was on some compilation cassette, and the song was memorable. And the title of the song and the chorus of the song, I remember, was Elvis Died on the Toilet. You know, there's actually a book about Elvis by Grail Marcus, the famous writer for Rolling Stone magazine, it's basically about the deification of Elvis. And here's another one of those like Michael Dean stories that sounds made up but is actually true. The cover, the first Bomb record, the cover of it is a picture in that book, because he's talking about Elvis's place in pop culture, even in underground pop culture. And the title of the first Bomb record is To Elvis in Hell. That's the name of the record, and it's actually inspired by a line in a song by the band Gun Club. They have a song, the line is, "You look just like an Elvis from hell." And Tony and I really like that line, and we called the song To Elvis in Hell. And there's actually somewhere, there's a picture of us in front of the gates of Graceland, all holding copies of that record. I don't have a copy of it, but there was a picture, and somebody probably has it and could scan it. But, yeah.
Groovy, man.
Yeah, man. Grail Marcus. Isn't Grail Marcus who Almost Famous is based on? I think it is.
I don't actually know.
It's one of those dingbats from Rolling Stone.
Dead Elvis. The book is called Dead Elvis, A Chronicle of Cultural Obsession by Grail Marcus. Came out in 1999.
Worms.
Yeah.
Yes.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Is your child defiant, independent, annoyingly inquisitive? After a long, hard day of following the rules, who wants to deal with troublesome kids? 49% of children suffer from oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Symptoms of ODD include independent thought, rampant creativity, and failure to submit to authority. But now there's a solution. The good people at Pilfer can help you with their time-release, once-daily capsule, Compliacin. Your child won't be able to form his own opinions, let alone express them. It maintains your child's ability to go to a state-run school and perform simple tasks around the house. You won't have to worry about parenting, and the school won't have to deal with your kid asking questions. Compliacin. You'll go from this.
Quit telling me what to do! Quit telling me what to do! Quit telling me what to do!
To this.
Good morning, Mother. I love going to school. And this week we're learning all about how the government is our federal family and they're here to help us.
Compliacin. Talk to your school psychiatrist and ask for it by name.
Wow. Last segment of this hour, and then we're going to come back and wind up Angela and let her go. Watch her go. So, I guess the bigger story here is Elvis and Nixon more than this show. I mean, by the way, Johnny Knoxville was in this show and did a serviceable job as friend number two. He was an interesting choice, but he probably begged to be in this. He's probably like, God, I gotta be in the Elvis movie. I don't care what I do. But, yeah. So, Elvis, Nixon... I remember Nixon resigning, and I remember hearing on the radio that Elvis died. You guys weren't alive when Nixon died. I heard
when Nixon died. I was alive when Nixon died.
Yeah, I'm sorry. When Nixon died as president, when he gave up being president, I heard a really funny take on it the other day. They kind of nailed it. It was Louis C.K. talking about it, and he's like, "Yeah, I hear people today complaining about the whoever's president. Like, I don't really like the president. He's kind of not. He's messing up a little bit." And Louis's like, "Are you kidding? When I was a kid, the president got on TV, cried, and then quit being president and got in a helicopter and flew away, and we never saw him again." It was that weird, man. I mean, I remember before he was, what I remember more than him resigning was the, like, I'm not a crook moment. And the Watergate trials. I remember the Watergate trials were like preempting everything on TV for weeks or days. You know, like maybe it was just the last week of it or something, but the climax of it. But I don't even remember how long it went on. And, you know, he was impeached. People think impeached means removed as president. It does not. Clinton was impeached, yeah, too. Yeah, impeached is being censored. It means you're spanked publicly, verbally. But and Nixon was impeached. You know, he was spanked publicly, and basically he quit before he got fired. They were going to remove him as president. Congress was. And the funny thing is, the ironic thing is, you know, not saying he's a good guy. He was a horrible guy, but he had to quit being president because he was somehow complicit. His people were complicit in bugging an office, one office. Whereas now, like, the president, whoever it is bugging everyone in America all the time. I mean, and it's accepted, you know? So.
Oh, the irony.
It is ironic. So, well, Angela, what are your memories of Nixon?
None, but I had to take a special topics Vietnam class in college. And I did not realize, and you know, I'm going to turn everything into a war thing, but Nixon and Vietnam, I mean, they're all horrible, Kennedy, Johnson, but reading about him and Kissinger, what horrible devil creatures. They're cartoon evil devil creatures.
You know what Nixon did that he ran under, and by the way, the reason he met with Elvis was because it would look good to voters when he was running for re-election, and he didn't want to meet with him. But the thing, Nixon basically ran under a platform of ending the draft, and he did end the draft. And it wasn't we think being drafted is slavery, and that's why we want to end it. It was actually a strategic thing because it turned out that about 90% of those anti-war protesters quit protesting once the draft was ended. You know, they weren't really that much against war. They just didn't want to go themselves. So the real hardcore anti-war people that were there before the hippies and after the hippies were the ones who were still protesting the war when the draft was gone.
Yeah, wasn't that Friedman's doing? Didn't he have something to do with that? Yeah. Yep.
So-called libertarian Milton Friedman, wasn't he an economic advisor to Nixon?
Reagan.
You got any story to Reagan? I think he had something to do with Nixon too.
He might have, yeah.
I mean, didn't he advise Nixon to end the draft?
That he did. That's what I said. I remember him being connected to that. And
yes. He may not have been an official advisor, but he was an advisor. He advised Nixon, and Nixon took his advice. So that makes him an advisor, even if it wasn't an official capacity. But wasn't he also an advisor to Pinochet?
Wait, hold on a second, because this has been as unnuanced a Milton Friedman discussion as you would get from a commie rag.
Back for hour two, you can have that discussion. Because we're going to the market. I don't know if you have your feet up, but... Although, if you got 10 seconds to sum it up, go ahead. Go.
Oh, heck no. I've got... thoughts take time.
When we get back... All right, your thoughts can brew for 8.5 minutes, and when we get back, it's 6 after the hour. You can go on a Milton Friedman rant. So make a few notes... And we'll talk about that when we get back, and we'll segue into this other movie.
Are you tired of stinky socialists trying to take over America?
And are you also tired of theorists talking about the free market as a cure-all for every problem with no first-hand experience of how the market actually works?
Well, the Truth Justice American Way app gives you wall-to-wall shows by hosts who not only understand the market, but tell you how they make money in a variety of patriotic endeavors.
The Truth Justice American Way app for Android is 24/7 streaming audio content on the topics of finance, liberty, self-defense, and technology.
All the hosts are all American Americans from all over America.
And the app is made in Wyoming, the cowboy state.
Because you should buy American, even with free Android apps.
Truth Justice American Way. Useful information, compelling personalities, and superior American audio quality.
Go on the Google Play Store or the Amazon App Store and search Truth Justice American Way.
God bless each and every one of you, and God bless America.
Broadcasting from the inside of a syringe full of Dilaudid going into Elvis's rotting corpse. That's what we're doing. While he makes sweet, sweet love to Nixon on top of my mama's grave. Yeah, I went there. If you're a fan of, well, you know, did you ever hear that line, my band Bahamas is, I met you by the light of the moon. We made sweet love on top of my mother's tomb. I went there. I went there while she was alive. She heard that song. So I have a correction from the last segment. I said that impeachment, well, part of what I said was true. I said impeachment is not being removed from office. Impeachment is being slapped publicly. And actually, I knew what I meant, but I didn't say it correctly. And someone corrected me, and my wife corrected me, and I looked up the exact wording so I can say this right. Impeachment is not the result. It's not the end. It's the beginning. Impeachment is bringing charges against any civil officer of government for crimes that have been committed while in office. Now, a lot of people think that impeachment means being removed from office because there were buttons that said impeach Nixon. That was a very popular saying, and probably the saying, you know, along with the guys from the Washington Post, that were some of the first leakers, go after the government kind of people, like real journalists back in the day. People thought that impeachment meant removed from office because impeachment, steps were taken. The impeachment was taken against Nixon, and he ended up out of office. And people who aren't really clear on the nuance think that he was forced out of office, you know, by fiat, by law, by demand. He was not. The impeachment was the process. The result was he quit during the process. People thought, you know, basically he was going to be removed from office as a result of the impeachment. So he quit before it happened because he didn't want to be as disgraced. Now, and so technically the impeachment of Nixon was unsuccessful. Now, Bill Clinton was impeached successfully and still remained president, which is possible.
Yeah,
what they decided to do was to censure him, which is a public verbal spanking.
He was neutered,
but you know.
Well, yeah, that's what it is. Like, I mean, for whatever power the president actually has to begin with, because I mean, I think we all know that he doesn't really actually wield the actual power. But for whatever power he allegedly does, that's what they did to him. They stripped him of most of that purported power, and just, you know, so the Republican Congress at the time could just do whatever they wanted.
Yeah,
that's what the story. That's how it was portrayed to the rest of us little people out here, from what I remember.
Yeah. And the other president that was impeached was Andrew Johnson in 1868. He got a spanking. So, Angela, you said that I was talking basically an inch wide to mile deep, or the other way around. Go ahead and give the truth about what I was talking about, the less bullet pointy, more detailed story.
It's part of a, it's a slight bug of mine, because some very, very good leftist authors in the past few years have, there's this compulsion to just, whatever this great topic is, just throw in a chapter about how Milton Friedman had something to do with it and how awful Milton Friedman is. And my God, this is the worst person who's ever lived, which has put me on somewhat of the defensive, but I'm not in any way, shape, or form defending Milton Friedman's brand of right-wing socialism. That's, you know, morally or from a utilitarian perspective, it doesn't work. It's ridiculous. But he did end the draft. He did help. Basically, he was instrumental in ending the draft. And that is conscription. When you think about it, I mean, even though it's a country that's had a history of chattel slavery, that there's a lottery, basically, that you have no choice to participate in, where you go and decide, you know, whether or not your leg gets blown off or not, all based on the loopy domino theory, which was, you know, that where, you know, we thought, oh my God, if one country far, far away was in communist, all the other countries would go and just be toppled and there'd be worldwide communism. And I fell for all that crap too. But that's, you know, it's clearly a very, very important thing of his ending the draft. You cannot understate that. But also, he came up with utilitarian arguments, economic arguments, for ending interventions and for not getting involved in the first place.
How'd that work out for America?
Well, what's important is you have to have utilitarian arguments against the war. You have to have arguments against the war that appeal to certain kinds of people. And Milton Friedman's arguments against intervention are very useful to a certain audience. And it's a great way for libertarians to subtly introduce certain ideas, and then you bring them closer to anarchism. But if you find the person in a certain kind of conservative space, you know, you meet that person where he or she is, and then you bring them in. So he
makes the economic
very
argument,
yes.
Basically, right?
Right.
Oh, I got a quick interjection. That movie Almost Famous is not about Grail Marcus. It's about Cameron Crowe, different writer for Rolling Stone. Okay, go on. Thanks. Sorry.
Oh, no. I have mixed feelings about Cameron Crowe movies, but Friedman, he's an important figure for our use in recruiting people. In terms of his actual economic theories, I think Chicago School will eventually go the way of
Dodo. I don't think it works, though, man. I mean, it seems like it should work. Like, if you talk to somebody who's really a conservative and say, you know, here's how much war costs, here's how much it's raising your taxes, here's how much it expands government. You say you're a small government person. You know, let's not have adventurism in 128 countries or whatever. And they say, but 9/11, you know, or but the army. And, you know, the amount of like disconnect of someone who, like, people who hate Obama as a president for real or imagined reasons, you know, for real or invalid reasons. There are people who hate him for both. Who still just love the war, you know, and like, well, Obama, you know, I mean, they'll get hung up on the Benghazi moment with, you know, where Hillary Clinton committed treason, basically. But, you know, in general, support the whole war. And that just runs counter to the economic argument, the conservative economic argument against war. What's wrong with those people, Angela?
Well, wait, you're partially right in that those economic arguments tend to be, they're not as effective as the moral ones or even the constitutional ones. I agree. But for a certain kind of right winger, they're great arguments. It just depends. I mean, there's so many different rights. I mean, the kind of right that's instinctively rah-rah USA military is a different right-winger from a more cynical, let's say, Bircher-ish, old right-ish kind of person who's kind of constitutionalist in the more pure, you know, in the more like old crumpy guy sense.
Yeah.
Those arguments work really well. Spending too much money arguments work really well. Very, yeah, appealing to
certain. But those people are the minority now. They're such the minority now, it seems like.
It's true, but we can't afford
Fox
to
News.
Not. Oh, Fox News is,
hey,
really
do you,
a sin.
Do you know about the alleged connection between the Nixon administration and the formation later of Fox News?
No, I do not. I want to know more.
Google this. It's kind of a conspiracy theory, but it's there may be some evidence, you know, some even better than blurry pictures with red arrows on them, that Nixon basically said, you know, I don't like this. The media are all left wing lunatics. We need a right wing news channel. And that, like, you know, he met with some powerful donors and it ended up being Fox News. I'll Google that while you tell me more about the argument.
It's a gawker story. But wait, I wanted to also just one more thing about Milton Friedman. The whole situation with Pinochet.
Nixon and Ailes planned to put the GOP on TV. Washington Post did an article on it. Roger Ailes, who is he? A-I-L-E-S?
Yes.
Who is that?
The person who was running Fox until probably 2 weeks ago.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So go on. School me.
Oh.
Let me ask you this. Give me the argument. Okay. Pretend I'm one of these grumpy old Bircher old school conservatives. And I'm like, well, we need to cut funding for everything except the military. Well, that needs to be strong and big. What's your argument?
Usually with those type of people, I do war by war. And once I kind of bring, because those kind of people have an instinctive distrust of centralized power, even if they are grumpy right-wingers. So it's very good to bring up the matter of, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Israel. Those, they'll be like, yeah, we can't be funding those, you know, blah, 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 SOBs or whatever you can say like that. That's kind of clean, but because they wouldn't curse. But that sort of thing. That's what you would probably go with, because they are very skeptical. And also the Constitution appealing to the idea that Congress and the executive have way too much power. And they do like that, because they call them conspiracy theorists or whatnot. But they have a critique of power that kind of makes sense if you're within that worldview, or at least what a conservative should be. Perhaps cranky, but you know, cranky people, even if they have, let's say, some vague, you know, racialist tendencies, they have enough sense to not go into other people's countries and disturb their peace, which should be a very basic human rights matter.
Ailes was the media consultant for Nixon and Reagan and George H.W. Bush and Rudy Giuliani. He was the media consultant, So there you go.
Thanks for sharing. She was making an argument, and that's what you come back with.
I'm footnoting her argument, you idiot. God, you are so cynical tonight. I'm just going to call you out on air about it. I think you're doing bad radio.
Not cynical.
I don't know. I'm footnoting what she said. I'm a few feet behind her. So, sorry, Angela, that Jeremy interrupted you. Go ahead.
What were we talking about? Were we talking about Pinochet and Chile? Or are we talking about Nixon?
Yeah, okay. You were getting at why that was a bunk argument.
Well, it's not entirely
what is the
bunk,
argument?
But it seems more subtle. Well, basically, I mean, they just, you know, basically people decided that, oh, yes, you know, Pinochet instituted those kind of economic forms.
Chicago-style economics, yeah.
Right. You know, Milton Friedman's purely responsible for the fact that, first of all, you know, how did Pinochet get into office, right? I mean, all of a sudden, Allende was over, you know, was murdered, suicide, overthrown.
CIA.
And the CIA. I mean, to give some more background, the issue of why the U.S. involvement of any kind in Latin America is considered horrible is because there's just nothing but the history of the CIA being there in Latin America, overthrowing regimes and
killing democratically elected leaders. Yeah.
Yes.
That's what
the
CIA
just horrible.
Does.
Right, exactly. And in Latin America, they've done it really well and to a really great degree. They're constantly disrupted. It's just disruption.
We're going to the market. We'll be back with more.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Wow. we had. Angela was telling us why so-called libertarian Milton Friedman was not directly responsible for Pinochet throwing people out of a helicopter. Tell us more.
To be fair, and the source of this itself is a little bit, you know, as an apologist source, it'd be Megan McArdle in The Atlantic. Milton Friedman only apparently spent an entire hour with Pinochet.
That's enough.
Wow.
That's enough for someone to say, I'm intrigued with your ideas and wish to subscribe to your newsletter.
Right. But to blame Milton Friedman for it's an overused term, the pure evil of the Pinochet regime is quite an overreach. Though, ethically speaking, I do think it's wrong for people in the U.S., since we live under the empire, to go to foreign countries and get involved this way. I think it's a very, very horrible thing, given what the CIA does and what the U.S. empire does with its various occupations and stationing troops in different countries.
Agreed. The U.S. backed Pinochet, correct? Because he was anti-communist?
Right.
To an extent. I mean, he was anti-communist. I don't know that he was so much anti-communist as the guy he killed to get rid of was a communist.
A socialist.
Know? Yeah. And it's kind of interesting how that enemy of my enemy is my friend thing works. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, If the guy in power that Pinochet had to kill to take the place of had been had been whatever the opposite of a communist is, I don't know, a capitalist, the U.S. wouldn't have helped it. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows why they pick which sides? Wasn't there a situation recently, Angela, you'd probably know the details of this, where two warlording factions in the Middle East who were at war with each other were both armed by the U.S. Isn't that true? You know about that?
I stopped following Syria when I realized I was going to just get nothing but grief and hate mail. Yes.
Yeah. 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 Short answer, yes.
this is like nonsense, you know? The kind of absolute lunacy where it's like, you know, where are they fighting Al-Qaeda? Where are they funding Al-Qaeda? Who's this group here in Syria? Who's this in the Islamic State? It's all lunacy and breakdown.
The bigger picture here, I mean, we could talk about this forever, but then we would just be, you know, Scott Horton show, but not nearly as well researched. Well, if Angela talked only, then we'd be as well researched. But, I mean, the bottom line here is, people need to look at what their government is doing, no matter where they are in the world. And, you know, I'm not just picking on the U.S., although the U.S. is obviously the biggest of this, but every nation does this kind of stuff to an extent, pretty much. And, you know, I mean, we're going to talk in the next segment about this movie, Welcome to Leith, about this really bad racist guy who moved to this little town in North Dakota and tried to take it over. And the movie rightly paints him as, you know, the devil, but compare him to, you know, the CIA or, you know, the U.S. military. The guy is hardly a devil. I mean, what did he do? He had four idiots move in with him and got some national news and was really impolite and mean to some people. That's all he did. That's hardly devilish compared to, you know, what your government, whoever you are listening, anywhere in the world, what your government's doing right now somewhere, you know?
If it's okay if I did one tiny quick follow-up.
Sure,
with
go ahead.
The one from the last part. Turkey, it was the Turkish president who had told reporters, okay, so basically he's accusing the U.S. of arming ISIS alongside Syrian Kurds. But the State Department, of course, says the U.S. never armed Kurds.
Yeah. Isn't the word genocide, didn't it originate, or was it the word Holocaust? No, it was genocide. Didn't that word originate to describe the Armenian situation with the Turks?
I don't know. I thought maybe it originated from the Holocaust era, and then later had been, when people finally started talking about it, been called a genocide.
Yeah.
I still think it's a relatively new term.
Yeah. Well, the Armenian thing being genocided by the Turks was earlier, right? That was around World War I-ish?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So whenever somebody tells you that somebody who's never killed anybody is worse than Hitler, you know, really, I mean, Trump is crazy, and I don't want anybody as president, especially these two that are running, but Hillary's far more like Hitler than Trump. Trump has probably never killed anybody yet. Hillary's killed a lot of people.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Been discussed recently on the show and probably will be discussed again because I know Steve Miller turned us on to it and he hasn't even been on this show to discuss it yet, but it's a movie called Welcome to Leith, which is about a guy named Craig Cobb, a white supremacist who moved to Leith, North Dakota about 3 years ago. Population 24, I think it was. I think it's now 18. It's actually gone down. I think he drove some people out of town. It's jokingly been called the Free Hate Project, kind of like the Free State Project, but for white power and hate of people who aren't white, basically because it's the same idea as the Free State Project of moving to an area and moving like-minded people to the area to change the mood of the area to make it a certain kind of place, which, you know, is basically the plan of the Free State Project. Do you guys know about the American, I don't know how to pronounce this, the American Redoubt or Redo, R-E-D-O-U-B-T? Have you either of you heard that term, Angela?
No.
Okay, I'm going to have to call you by name. Angela, have you heard that? No. Jeremy,
no.
Have you
no,
heard that?
I hadn't heard the term until you sent me that.
Yeah, it's there was a guy, a writer named James Wesley Rawls, and I mistakenly said last night that this was a racial plan. And the reason that they're saying it's not racial, I still say it might have had some racial component. It was basically an idea first proposed in... Actually, it says 2011. I think that's incorrect because I thought I heard about this concept back around the, it's got to be older than that, around the beginning of the Free State Project. I thought it was an influence on the Free State Project, but it's basically an idea to make Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Eastern Oregon, and Eastern Washington into a safe haven for conservative, libertarian-leaning Christians and Jews. And I guess the reason they say that it's not racist is because it includes Jews, too. But there's actually a weird brand of Christian exclusionism that is Christians and Jews and nobody else. Have you guys ever encountered that thing?
Yes, I
have.
Yes.
Is there a name for it?
It depends. I mean, it's often discussed in the context of Christian Zionism.
Explain that.
Well, this is somewhat very modern and somewhat atheological, something, you know, not kind of a post-Protestant politicization of Christianity in the U.S., but since the 80s, there's been a rise of people more fundamentalist or evangelical, which are different things in Christianity, of people who have become strong supporters of the state of Israel. So yeah. Much so that that they want our foreign policy shaped around that.
I think it's actually a really small religious movement that's become a huge influence on U.S. foreign policy. Is that accurate, Angela?
Well, according to the journalist who does the best work on this is Max Blumenthal, and I believe his figures are something like 24 million Christian Zionists in the U.S. It's quite a voting block.
Certainly not a majority, and it really seems to me that the U.S. has almost become the Army of Israel, the United States Army, because it seems like, you know, everyone that is their enemy is the enemy of Israel. Except then there's Saudi Arabia, which is a kind of weird wobbler of like friend, enemy, frenemy, maybe the government of it may have been behind 9/11. That's a theory now. That's maybe a little more in the theory. But yeah,
the U.S. has a lot of troubled friends.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, there's the relationship with Turkey, which is tormented, and with places like Bahrain, you know, that are just horrible, you know, horrible on human rights. There's two ways of looking at it. I tend to still see Israel as more of a convenient air base. It's perfectly located for the U.S. empire, and once the issue of apartheid becomes better known here in the U.S., or if it no longer really serves a practical purpose for the U.S. empire, that support will end.
You mean Palestinian apartheid?
Right. I call it, it's just like the way you call it South African apartheid.
Right. You know, well, I just had to clarify, yeah. Because 98% of the people listening probably thought you were talking about Africa if they know at all the word apartheid. But
right, yes, yeah. I'm sorry, yes.
Define apartheid, explain it.
It's a political system that's explicitly hierarchical based on race. Where there's not the same level of human rights for people put in certain categories. You're not guaranteed the same constitutional rights or whatever rights.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that's happening there. There's also comparisons depending on what part of that region you're talking about. Comparisons to Jim Crow, and then comparisons to, you know, Gaza being basically at this point a camp. So those are the problems surrounding that. Those are problems that. The U.S. could not be implicated in if it removed funding to Israel. So, I mean, it can be as simple as an economic issue. You don't have to necessarily think about the human rights of Palestinians. It may not matter. You may just say, okay, I just don't think we should be funding anyone. You know, there's lots of foreign aid in that part of the world.
And you know who'd probably agree with you on that? Is Craig Cobb, the star of the movie. I'm not saying you're racist, but I don't know. He might be pro-Israel. I don't know.
I'm trying to remember because it's been a few months since I saw that movie. But Craig Cobb is the cartoon professional racist.
There you go.
And he's an interesting character study, and it's very, very interesting to see how, you know, and entirely understandably, people react and are cringing to having this cretin and his kooky loser friends there with them. And that's, you know, and people can choose, you know, people do have a basic right to be, you know, decide with whom they're going to associate. So it's understandable that people may not want to live next door to a, you know, someone like this. But what is interesting about, I mean, those are very interesting movies and that interesting phenomenon, but there's a few things that are never understood, and this is kind of the problem with liberalism and white liberals in particular, and I'm sure someone will now call me a racist, but whatnot. But the mentality that the kind of racism of Craig Cobb is somewhat far more harmful than, let's say, the whole system of police brutality where African Americans are targeted day in and day out, which is completely acceptable to liberals in most cases. I mean, they don't like maybe bad words, you know, bad ethnic slurs coming out of the mouth of police officers, but they're still comfortable with the whole notion of policing and over policing, let's say, and, you know, in communities they deem needed more. So it's always like cartoon people like Craig Cobb. Yeah, they're ridiculous, but they don't have any power to enact anything, and they're probably, in some cases, some of his followers are mostly just the products of, you know, Federal Reserve creates all these economic problems for all these young men who don't have jobs and don't have any prospects, and what the heck are they going to do with their time? They got to blame someone.
Yeah. You know, interesting thing about that movie, it's that really stood out to me as someone who lives in that part of the country. And, you know, as I said the other day, North Dakota is technically the Midwest and Wyoming is technically the Mountain West, but Wyoming, where I live, and North Dakota, where this movie takes place, have a lot more in common than North Dakota does with Ohio, for instance, that is also considered part of the Midwest. We're both like barren prairies, you know, large expanses of undeveloped lack of people. You know, the opening scenes of Welcome to Leith, where it's just showing these vast expanses of nothing, look exactly like it looks if you go 5 miles outside of my town, or even, you know, a couple miles outside of my town in one direction. And I don't know. It's the thing that really stood out to me was that it's one of the few movies I've ever seen made by city slickers about country bumpkins where they don't make the country bumpkins look bad. And I realized the reason they had to do that was to make the subject of the documentary look worse. Like, basically, you know, I mean, if you look at another documentary, like any documentary about the gay kid that got killed in Wyoming, there was actually a lot of locals say that that wasn't a gay crime, hate crime, that was a thing about a drug deal gone bad. But anyway, it's kind of become like the cause celeb for Hollywood of, you know, Wyoming's bad because they kill gay people. You know, if you look at any of the documentaries about that, they pretty much make everyone from Wyoming look like an inbred, you know, baby eating hick. But this documentary, Welcome to Leith, made the citizens of Leith look like hardworking salt of the earth who should be respected for who they are. And the only reason they did that was because they had to make the point in the documentary of that Craig Cobb is worse than Satan, you know? And I'm sure the people of Leith are probably hardworking salt of the earth who deserve respect. But, you know, it's kind of surprising to see a city slicker film production, you know, paint that reality as it is, more or less.
You mean actually think about classism and the way they present the material?
Well, not only to think about it, but to make the conclusion of we're going to consciously paint them this way. Because generally anything, there's a book called The Redneck Manifesto by Jim Goad. Are you familiar, either of you familiar with him or that book?
Yes, yeah. I read it many years ago.
What's your opinion of it?
I don't know if it would have aged well to me. It was mildly amusing and transgressive then, but already Jim Goad's brand of subversiveness had already kind of worn thin. He's written a column for Talkie for years, so he's become
a right-wing kook. Yeah. He's become a right-wing kook, whereas he was kind of a interesting, kind of almost libertarian anarchist back then. But the basic premise of that book, I still believe, is true, which is that rural whites are the only ethnic group it's okay to heavily make fun of. And that if you said that, you can say still, you know, back then, 15 years ago when that book was written or more, and now still, like, you can say things about rural whites on mainstream TV that if you said it about gays, Jews, blacks, Arabs, any other group, Muslims, Catholics, you know, anybody, well, maybe not Catholics, but, you know, you wouldn't have a job in Hollywood. You know, he basically said that, like, white people are the last scapegoat. And it's pretty much true, I would say, in the media. And that's kind of what I'm pointing out about this, of, like, generally when you see a documentary that's made by people who aren't from, you know, who aren't showing their people, they generally kind of show those, you know, people from white people from rural areas as stupid hicks, and they didn't do that in this. And I kind of liked it about it.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at GetCell411.com. That's GetCell411.com.
I sent you guys some stuff we can read for the Redemption, the third act. So I sent you guys this picture, too, that Steve Miller did of Paul Gordon from below with a bad audio is a hate crime sticker on his mouth. It says, and there's a typo in this, but if you want to use this for the show, I don't care. But it says, you ever get so libertarian that you write a lengthy, heartfelt eulogy for a stillborn cryptocurrency? Which is talking about how Paul Gordon wrote a kind of a eulogy for what I would not call a stillborn cryptocurrency. I'd call it one that didn't live very long. It was a Bitcoin that we created and lasted for 8 days and worked and then disappeared because problems. Basically, we didn't have the manpower to keep it going as a team. And instead of doing what most cryptocurrencies do when they realize that, probably after 8 days, if they're smart, is that, you know, most of them like kind of let it go and get on exchanges and people start selling it and believing it a little bit when it's flawed from the beginning and ends up tanking. And, you know, we just decided to put a bullet between its eyes, put it out of its misery before it got to that point, which was, a lot of people think, the smarter thing to do. Although there were some naysayers who were like, it usually lasted 8 days. And I'm like, how long did your cryptocurrency last? That's my question to the naysayers. And their answer is, I don't have one. All right. So would you guys read these two comments we got from users that are more eulogizing of the short-lived cryptocurrency Bitcoin, please?
I can't because I did not receive them.
All right, Jeremy,
I can read mine. All right. Sure. David wrote, Michael, I just wanted to express my condolences for the ultimately but understandable demise of Bitcoin, which was euthanized at the age of 8 days. A Bitcoin. Did I say Bitcoin? I apologize.
No,
I
can't, but I'm clarifying for people listening, you know, in their car with their grandkids talking in the back seat, going from the church picnic to the VFW hall, which is how I picture most of our listeners on radio. Although I don't know why they're taking their kids, their grandkids, from church to the VFW hall picnic at 1 a.m. But maybe that's how it works in Leith, North Dakota. All right.
I had heard of and read a bit about the similarly named quite successfully cryptocurrency Bitcoin, as well as other cryptocurrencies, but I had never previously bothered to actually learn in detail, let alone mine or otherwise acquire any cryptocurrency until Bitcoin came along. Then I figured, hey, it's from MWD, Derek Slopey, Brian Gordon, and the good folks at BSLIC Internet Policy Commission Outreach Team. Plus, it's covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. So it must be good. Why don't I give it a try? And I did. I followed the directions, and apart from the occasional teething troubles, some perhaps due to the errors of the well-interested but
well-intentioned but faulty
implemented mining pool that you described on the Fiends. Oh, it worked most of the time until you shut down everything. I mined a little bit of Bitcoin before that happened. It was fun. So you, and as you insisted it would be. And I learned some interesting stuff about how cryptocurrencies work in practice.
That's good. So it's kind of like the training wheels for Bitcoin. I think that's what Bitcoin was for some people. A lot of people mined and traded Bitcoin, who have never even, you know, had a wallet for Bitcoin. So yeah. And I kind of like the idea, too, that there are people who will try any software that we come out. It's kind of like, do you ever have a record label that you like? Like Discord Records is like that for a lot of people, or Alternative Tentacles, you know, like labels that anything that they put out, people will listen to. I like being the software version of that. It's fun.
Sure. Well, I had never mined before until Bitcoin came around. So,
did you ever successfully mine any?
Yes, before I went to Michigan and got made fun of by people, including Paul Gordon, for having to miss out on all the mining over the weekend. I had actually successfully mined 41 bips.
Nice. Well, so, you know, there's a theory. Steve Miller started a rumor that Bitcoin only existed for me to pay my debt that is allegedly owed to the Fiendsters Union of 15 bips each. and then was dissolved after that, but that's not really true. But I like the theory. I like the conspiracy theory.
Well, it is a good theory.
Well, we're headed out. It's been a good show. Got closing comments, kids?
Yeah.
Thanks, Angela. Glad you finally got your fiend bone working again.